Welcome to another weird, wild, and wacky week in the world of genre movie news. I am Brian C. Wood, along with my co-host, as always,
Chad Metz.
And you have now tuned into the Movies on the Brain podcast. We have just gotten out of our screening of Ant-Man and the Wasp, the newest Marvel movie that is very low rated because it does not contain Pepper Potts.
God, we're going to do this again.
Yes.
You're starting early this time.
Yes. Well, I have to start early because she won't be in Captain Marvel either because it predates her by like 20 years. So.
But you found a way to sneak her into this one and she's not in.
No, she's
nowhere
not.
Around this.
Nowhere even close around this. So, Chad, our overall general thoughts and perceptions on the wee Ant-Man of the MCU?
So, I think it's exactly what I expected it to be. I expected it to be like the first one. Ratcheted up a little bit, and that's exactly what I got. When it comes to Ant-Man, it's like the family fun one, and that's exactly what this is. So, I don't know. People don't seem to grasp on the Ant-Man as much as I do for, you know, family reasons. But if you like family fun, this is the movie for you. If you didn't really like the first Ant-Man, you could probably skip this one and just check out what the post stingers were and be happy.
So I feel like this is an upgrade from the first one. I think they got a better budget. I think they did some better things. I think the miniature work is amazing, and I think that it's a fun film. It is more in line with the post Civil War ramifications than anything else.
Yes.
But they've been telling us that for a year. I mean, they told us that at the Comic-Con panel last July. So, I mean, you know, let's get into what is our good or not so good and our bad for this film.
So my good is, overall it's just a fun feel. Like I was entertained to the whole thing. Again, part of the heart of the first Ant-Man is his whole relationship with his daughter. And that one is so much on the father-daughter relationships between Hank and Hope and Scott and Cassie. And this one, it doesn't have as much of that because we're adding the element of Janet into the mix. But you still get those moments, particularly with Scott and Cassie. It's not that many, but it reminds you of why this one is more grounded. I'm saying grounded when in this movie we see big, bacteria almost eat a spaceship. But as grounded as you can be when you're talking about, you know, the heart of the movie, which is these family relationships. So that's good that they kept that and changed it a little bit, but kept what was familiar about the first one.
I'd agree. I feel like there is a strong contingent of women in this film. Like, Cassie is a stronger woman in this film than she was in the first. A stronger presence and just a more mature, girl in this movie. And I don't mean that in a Michael Bay way. I mean that in a, you know, she's a bigger part of his life and she's more able to understand what her dad's role in all of this is and able to be more supportive of him in it. And, you know, Hope feels some kind of way about the attempts to go get her mother and about the kind of, we get way more about what their relationship was like. We get the whole backstory of, you know, how her relationship with her father changed, you know, when he came home from that mission. I feel like even, you know, between Cassie, Hope, and Janet, that you get three different tiers of women at three different points in their lives who are all facing ideas about what parenthood means and what parental relationships mean and how they affect them. You know, the weird interlude with Scott channeling Janet and some of the things that get said there. The very limited number of things that get said when she finally does emerge from the quantum zone. And I guess we should have said spoilers, but if you clicked on this, you know that there's a spoiler cast coming because we just got out of the movie. But I feel like that's a strong part of the film. My good is Cassie. I love what they do with her in this film. Because they hint at what she is in the comics, which is a follow-on to her father. And they leave that room there. And I love Michael Peña. I think that he is funny. I think that he is charming and witty. I don't need a whole solo movie of him and his security gang.
No,
but I just need more of those trippy stories. I love the Quantum Zone. This is beautiful, and it's going to be till what, maybe 2021 by the time I get another Doctor Strange movie.
If you're lucky, yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, the kind of trippy imagery, I felt like they did it just as well in Ant-Man as they did in Doctor Strange, and I think they took it to the next level here. The bacteria, I thought was a really nice setup. The way that the zone looks when Hank is walking, you know, walking through it, I think it was beautifully designed. And setting forth the rules of the zone and talking about different things, including time vortexes and things, it helps inform your ideas of what's going on. So that would be those would be my good things from the film. What's your not so good, Chad?
So my not so good is going to be science, because this movie is.
You really should not watch Interstellar then. That'd be 3 hours if you just wanted to throw stuff at the screen.
I mean, all of these big blockbuster things are based in science in quotation marks. Yeah, you got to take them with a grain of salt and just kind of pass by them, but, you know.
You mean you can't survive a space station getting blown up and you can just orbit around the Earth and then eventually find your way back?
No, that's not how that happens. You die. That's more than likely what happens.
Don't tell that to Star Wars nerds.
Why do we have to bring that up, too? Yeah, I won't say those words.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, they make a whole joke out of the because they say quantum so many times, they make a joke out of it. They make it fairly early on, and they kind of stop saying it at that point, which is interesting, because they said it a lot up until that point. But even within the science that we're just kind of, you know, asked to believe and give them the benefit of the doubt, I get into it with science when, like, you give rules, and then you don't follow the rules, and it kind of just breaks my brain a little bit. Like, I'm never going to get over the whole Back to the Future thing. It's just never going to happen. I love those movies. Just never going to happen. In this, the rules established in the first one was, you go Smith Hall, you got to have that helmet on, because you can't breathe without the helmet. So, I mean, they played with Scott's size, and he got, like, kid size, and all that's fine. But he got to Quantum Realm, and Hank starts losing his mind. When he wakes up, he got no helmet, and he's there. And then Janet shows up, and she takes off her helmet, and it's like, it broke my brain. I can't, like, you gave me a rule, and you broke a rule. I already know the workaround you're going to give me for that rule, but still, like, if you would have broken, like, established that workaround in the movie before this part, I probably would have been fine. That's kind of all my thing is. If you're going to give me rules, I like you to stick to the rules. If you're going to break the rules a little bit, but only for certain occasions, you got to tell me why. And I will give you all the leeway in the world. If not, we're here. And I have to rant about that. The other not so good, I thought the comedy in this one felt a little forced to me. And it, like, there's a lot of stuff that it feels like trying to get a big laugh, and I didn't have a big laugh with some of it. I laughed at it. It is funny, but there's just some parts that just didn't work. I knew they were trying to get a laugh, and I was like, it worked better in the first one. Not the Luis thing. That was still good. That one, they found a way to do it. They actually incorporated it into the story, and it pays off better in this one than it was in the first one. So that's good, but some of the other comedy,
Okay, well, first of all, Chad, I hope that you've written that letter to Mr. Kinberg, because he's going to write all kinds of rules and then break them next February or March or whenever that movie comes out.
Why do you keep bringing up things that you know like rises my blood pressure.
Well, Mr. Kinberg is going to want to mess with your head there and give you false hope and then take it away.
Actually, you know what? They don't mess with my pressure because I have no expectations for them. It's just like...
Well, they have no rules.
Well, yeah.
They clearly have no rules, Chad.
They have no rules. That ship sailed in the third one. And, you know what? I let it sail. I waved
that was 2005, out. Dude. They've had no rules since 2005.
13 years. 13 years.
And he's going to get to remake the whole movie over.
Yep. And we'll just sit there. What's the Michael Caine line from The Dark Knight?
Men just want to watch the world burn.
Yeah, that's what this is going to be.
So, my not so good. I miss the fact that, you know, Judy Greer is in the movie and she's not utilized very much. I am disappointed in the fact that we get all hyped because the very first announcement last Comic-Con, the big reveal of the opening of the Marvel panel at Comic-Con last year was we got Michelle Pfeiffer to play Janet Van Dyne. Well, you better hope this movie makes bank so you can make a third Ant-Man because she ain't going to be in whatever Avengers 4 is going to be called. And the only place she fits is an Ant-Man sequel. So you better hope this movie makes money because otherwise you just paid Michelle Pfeiffer a whole bunch of money to be on screen for like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Maybe tops. So those would be my not so good things. Not utilizing Lawrence Fishburne properly. And having him fluctuate between basically be a tweener, you know, go back and forth between being a heel and a face as we continue to use the parlance of wrestling. Like, either stick to one or the other. It's all kind of, you know. And the thing for me is I like Ghost. I like the concept of Ghost. I like the tragedy behind her story, how it ties into the hubris of Hank Pym. And you know, I like her as a... I just feel like she was underserved.
Yeah.
I think she was used more as a... what I would call a roadblock or a stumbling block to our heroes to getting where they needed to go. So it kind of felt like a convenient out that any time Hope, Hank, and Janet... or Hope, Hank, and Scott got close to having everything they needed to open the portal and go get Janet, that Ghost would come in and just take the thing. Or Walter Groggins' character would come in and take the thing. Or, you know, Lawrence Fishburne's character come in and take... Like, it just kind of felt like okay, we need to push the movie back another 20 minutes, so we're going to have this. But I think the tragedy of her story, her power set, it raises an interesting question that I don't think very many people are going to come out of this movie thinking. But if S.H.I.E.L.D. was infected by Hydra, and Hydra had access to the Winter Soldier, but they also, through S.H.I.E.L.D., had access to this, to Ghost, why did you need Winter Soldier? Because Ghost is infinitely more capable of being an assassin and being undetectable and being... going on secret missions and completing them with never no one even knowing she's there as opposed to Winter Soldier.
If it were me, and it's not me, my answer to that would be
they had to put Bucky on ice and this she was doing things because she openly says I did missions.
He's easier to control because they can put him back on ice. Whereas with her power set, like when she just wigs out, like what are they gonna do? They can't stop her. They can't touch her. So she's more at risk of being a loose cannon.
But she was always hemmed in from being a loose cannon because she was always promised that they would heal her.
Yeah,
and it took her a while to figure out that they wouldn't.
Also, it seems like her power as she got older, her powers progressed where she was more unstable and.
They gave her a suit.
Yeah, and you can argue that she was more stable then, and they could have more ways to control it. But if they wanted it out, that would be my out. I don't fully accept that out, but
I don't necessarily think it's the thing people are going to be asking when they come.
No, because I
mean, it'll be a list on some Nerdist's, you know, 7 unanswered questions coming out of Ant-Man and the Wasp, but it's not something that, like, is going to start an internet fan debate about whether or not they need to reshoot this movie completely.
Nope, because I think the biggest takeaway from Ant-Man and the Wasp is going to be actually them combined. I mean, I know that spoiler again for the very last one, all you do is see the ant playing the drums, but it's the whole devastation
post-apocalyptic society.
You see what it's like, what regular people would see if this thing just happened. The cable goes, the TV goes to the death screen with that noise that you're familiar with if you see the rainbows of death on TV, and there's just nothing there, and things are just all about so that combined
again with Kirk Cameron's wet dream. It continues to be played out in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
I think our audience knows who Kirk Cameron is, but if not, just go ahead and Google him, and
that'll be more than sufficient. Although yeah, you might get some tie-ins to Nick Cage, which would also be pretty a pretty interesting read right now.
Yeah. But I think for the mass majority of people, the biggest takeaway is going to be the post-credit scenes, which kind of
first time in a long time we get one that actually feels like a true coda to the movie.
Yeah, but I don't know who walked in there not expecting to see some version of this. It was always a matter of which ones. The suspects were always going to be the four that we got, the 2 Ant-Men and 2 Wasp. They were always going to be the prime suspects. It was like, which ones are going to go? I always was hoping that it would not. I thought it would just be Hank, because you just got Janet back, and you know this whole thing about Marvel and lack of women. You just established a badass superhero in the Wasp, and then you take her off the table.
Yeah, you established a really great Wakandan king and then took him away.
This is true. So,
took away all the Guardians of the Galaxy except for Rocket.
Only the Trash Panda stays.
Yeah.
But that along with what you were just saying kind of ties into what I would say is my bad, which is the underutilization of the women characters that you do have, like in Janet. And Ghost particularly, because Janet's not there for very long, and I think Ghost is great for when she's there, but like you said, she's like a stumbling block. I mean, she's not the worst Marvel villain by far.
She got one of the better backstories that you could totally explore, especially now that you've kept Lawrence Fishburne's character, you know, Bill, alive.
Yeah.
And you've kept them together.
I mean, and you her backstory makes her sympathetic, and it makes Hank look like
continuously. Which the only thing about that is for me, like, there's example after example after example here of times for him to show his temper the way they showed it in the first one, and you just don't see it as much.
Yeah, like when we first see him and Scott first sees him, I really thought he was gonna punch Scott,
which he should have.
Yeah, I thought he would. I thought it fit, but you know.
When he goes back to see Bill for the first time, they have to step in between him.
And that one felt earned, and I'm good with that one. There was something else that seemed like he should have lost his temper at some point. But I really think he should have hit Scott.
Yes.
But, you know. But all, there was some, I was going to make another point, but I forgot. I think it was going to go back to Ghost, and they came up with a good character. They just didn't have as much to do with her as I would like, because she was just so single focused on just get the building. That was kind of it. Her backstory made her flesh out a lot more than everybody else, and her power set is actually borderline on too powerful. But you know, they made it work, and when you actually got into the Ant-Man Wasp and Ghost fights, and they're all like shrinking and getting big, and she's phasing through stuff, they did some really good work with that. So I can't complain too much. And I mean, this is the worst thing I got to say about the movie. It's not that bad.
Okay, my bad. Pepper Potts is not in the movie. The other part bad would be, look, not enough ants, man. I mean,
There
are not enough ants, man. Like, I know we got a whole bunch of time with them in the first movie, and we understand how important they are to the first movie. But I feel like they're not utilized as well this time, and there's no ante. You know, there's no personal attachment to an ant. I mean, they make a joke at one point about seagulls just picking these things off like they're nothing. I mean, it doesn't feel like they're as important. There are two spots. One is when they have to, you know, disconnect everything so that they can't go through with Ghost's rehabilitation. And two would be
that's when they broke him out of jail.
When they broke him out of the FBI headquarters, with the most prickish FBI agent around. Was he also related to the principal from?
No, he's not a prick. He's like that well-meaning
Mr. Magoo.
Yeah, well-meaning, but can't quite get it right. Even though he's actually like he's not bad at his job because he knows everything that happens. He just can't ever like get there to be like aha. Which is supposed to play into the humor. But I like Randall Park. So it's a small role. It's fine.
But I mean, like, not enough ants. And for me, the other straight up bad is just going to be the humor. And it's not that it's bad humor. It's not that it's raunchy humor or anything like that. McKay and Rudd formulated a good beat on the humor through that first film, that, and it's continued on in Civil War, that feels natural. Mm-hmm. It feels effervescent. It feels very much like Rudd's personality, and it shines through it. It's sharp, and it's well-written, and it just flows, which is what good dialogue does. I don't feel that here. I feel like you're going for laughs.
Yeah.
Literally going for laughs. I feel like you're not served well by your marketing materials that pretty much spoil a lot of what your sight gags are going to be, that those are in the marketing materials. And you feel the weight of five writers and Rudd just being one. And, you know, I understood that you weren't going to get McKay back because he was going off to prepare to do his Dick Cheney biopic at the time that they were doing all of this. But it would seem to me that Peyton, with his sensibilities from the Bring It On franchise, had enough background in comedy with Rudd. The two of them could have hammered out a script. Mm-hmm. That you didn't need three other people to come in and do a pass on. And with that set, the way that it's always going to have some improvisation on it, I felt the comedy could have been more natural, could have been more flowing. And again, I don't think they were helped by their marketing campaign, but I mean, I just, like, I miss an Adam McKay, Paul Rudd written movie, which is crazy considering they did that within, like, 8 weeks because of the time crunch of everything.
Yeah, like, when the movie was over and I saw the story by credits, I'm like, oh, that is not surprising at all. And that's not to say that you can't have a number of writers and not have a decent movie. I mean, Spider-Man Homecoming got knocked for that same thing, but I think that movie's fine for it.
But we all knew that Goldstein and my boy John Francis Daley were the lead writers on that. Mm-hmm. Watts had some input, but it was Daley and Goldberg who were writing that film. We knew that, yeah, there was a version out there, and if it's not me, somebody's going to get to write the book about the MCU. They're going to have to talk about what the heck Cornish's and Edgar's script contained, because it didn't contain anything about the quantum realm. Mm. So we're really going to have to, like, dig deep to find out what that script was like. And then, you know, all indications are you basically had to throw it away and start from scratch with 6 weeks to go to filming. And to put two guys in there in that situation and have the script come out as beautifully as it did, is a testament. And I, like I said, I understand he was off writing his Chaney movie or getting ready to film his Chaney movie, but that doesn't mean you couldn't... I mean, Coogler did a pass on the Creed II script, and I think it's going to end up being for the better. I mean, as ham-fisted as that trailer looks, I mean, there are still moments that of that shine through with Coogler's, you know, ideas about what that character is and how the character would relate. I don't know why they wouldn't have run a script past McKay to get some input. You know, Joss had input on some of the Black Widow stuff at various points because he helped form that character.
Yeah.
I mean, so it just kind of felt, and again, they weren't helped by their marketing. All the sight gags are in the marketing. All the beats for the movie are in the marketing. The other thing I'll say that is my bad is the pacing of this film. This film moves, and it moves way too fast. And I say that it's not supposed to be a bad thing. It's that, like, you have a very simple plan. Your very simple plan is to go get Janet. You have to actually invent ways to prevent you from getting to Janet quicker than what you do. But because you have to keep inventing methods for keeping them from getting Janet, it just feels like the movie is moving faster because it's kinetic and it's jumping from this fight to that fight to that fight to this fight to that fight, which is completely unnecessary because really they just should have possession of the lab the entire time. I mean, if you want to take it away from them once, great, but we don't need to keep doing the same.
We literally play hot potato at one point.
And, you know, one table spot is good. But if you do five table spots in a row, it kind of loses its touch.
Yeah. I mean, we're almost literally playing hot potato from the moment Hank and Hope show up. I mean, and again, I get that's kind of the point of it. But yeah, there are some moments that, as I'm sitting here thinking about, I'm like, yeah, that was fun, but it was just like there and then gone. Like the stuff with
legitimately could be a 90-minute movie.
Yeah, like the stuff with them going to Cassie's school. Like, it's a fun little gag, but it's like there and gone. Just done. So
the chase through San Francisco takes too long.
It
changes hands like 7 times. I mean, I guess the point of all that is to have Giant Man, which is, again, goes back to concept art that was shown at the open house night before Guardians.
Yeah.
And the same concept art that was shown last year at Comic-Con. Yep. But, I mean, you know, you could have done that another way, you know.
Yeah, that's... Like, I like everything about it, but yeah, if you cut it down, find a way to cut it down some, it probably is better for it.
I think the pacing of this works at 90 minutes. I don't think it works at 120, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
I think at 120 it drags, and I think at 120 it feels... I don't want to say bloated, because the only time you feel bloated is when you're watching a Michael Bay movie, but like, you know, it feels like you could have cut down the number of spots, and you would have been better off.
It's like watching it, I never felt the time, but sitting here thinking about it, it's like, yeah, it's like they could have got like this, got rid of this, or cut some of this, but you know, it's again, it's enjoyable. I think if you like fun stuff,
and how many times do we have to do the I've got to beat the FBI back to my house?
They only did it twice, but it feels like more than that.
Because he never shuts up about it.
Yeah. Like, every time something happens, like, I gotta go. Like, now. And then sometimes now is, like, not right now, and we gotta do it, like, 5 minutes later. Sometimes, like, right now.
I mean, and I feel like Peyton's direction's good. I feel like it's solid. I feel like his music choices are annoying. But, I mean, like, I feel like it's a solidly made movie, and it's fun, and it's effervescent. It just has... I feel like there are more issues to this film than there were to the last film.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I think that's just, you know, because you had the setup for this done in the first one. You There's a reason they obscure Janet's face from everything.
Yeah.
So let's get to those post-credit stingers. Because, as we said, they are feel like a natural conclusion to a natural continuation of the film. Mm-hmm. I'd argue that's probably the first time that's happened since Iron Man 3. The post-credit stinger that reveals that he's been talking to Banner the entire time, and that's where his narration has come from. I mean, this is the, like, none of the rest of them feel like natural continuations. I mean, maybe the PSA from Cap after Homecoming, but I mean,
not really, no. Because right. It's just something you see in the movie. It's not actually a part of the movie. Like, this is, okay, we've resolved the movie, but we need to still do this stuff that involves things in the movie. And then it's just going to tie in to the big monster that we all knew was coming.
Right. So we get the ending to the movie. Hank reveals that he's, you know, shrunk the house. Honey, I shrunk the kids. I shrunk the house. It blows the house up. They have their own private island. You have the nice little touching moment with the family drive-in, which is cute. You know, the movie ends. Everybody feels happy. You know, Scott's been released from house arrest. Everything is great. And so we get to the post-credit stinger. You know, with the van, Luis's van with his Mexican horn has been retrofitted with a small quantum tunnel. It's the same quantum tunnel from the lab. It's just been shrunk down to fit inside of a trunk of a car, of a van. And as we learn from Janet's monologue after she gets back, she has healing powers. She, you know, the place has evolved her to the point where she has that kind of healing power, which may or may not come into play later. But she touches Ghost and heals Ghost to bring her back to her solid form, which in and of itself is ironic because she wanted to kill Janet. But so they send Scott into the quantum realm through this reduced quantum tunnel to retrieve quantum particles that will help continue to heal Ghost. Ghost is last seen with Bill on the run. So they send him in. He gets there. He gets the particles. Closes the canister. Calls for him to be pulled back. They count him down to 3. And nothing happens.
Mike's go dead.
Pull out. Camera pans to the black ash that we all know. Fading away. Where all three of them stood. So the implication being that when Thanos snapped his fingers in Wakanda, that Hank, Janet, and Hope all vanished away, leaving Scott trapped in the quantum realm with time vortexes that if you fall into, we can't help you. And no way to get home.
Yeah, the mention of time vortexes is going to be the interesting point in this, because everybody's like, how are we going to undo this? So the minute you keep we already have the mechanism with the time stone, and now you say time vortexes, is like, well, are we really building towards time
travel? I may end up being the only person who catches that, because she lists off a couple of different things to be careful for in the quantum zone.
This is true.
But the only one that she mentions that really pops to the ears is time vortexes. Yeah. So what do we think? Good tie-in to Infinity War? Because, I mean, this explains to us what they were doing when the events of Infinity War occurred. They were off on their island together trying to retrieve particles to, you know, help Ghost and, you know, break the Sokovia Accords.
Yeah, I think it's a good lead-in because some people were confused about when this movie took place. I always knew that it was going to take place, like, before Infinity War or, like, during Infinity War.
The 2 years, it's very specifically stated, 2 years from the events of Civil War.
Yeah.
Which puts it right before the events of Infinity War.
Yeah. So there's probably a little bit of time between the actual end of the movie and the beginning of this one, and it lines up right with Infinity War, and they always had to put this capper to like tie in and explain where Ant-Man and the Wasp are when we get to whatever the next Avengers movie is, because we know that Ant-Man is in it.
We know the Wasp is in it.
We know Wasp is in it as well. So that's going to naturally make it appear that she's going to be in it when everybody comes back. But Scott is a bigger question because he's been. The scenes that they've always talked about with Ant-Man that leaked from the set were the scenes of Cap in his old Avengers uniform. And again, when you said time vortexes, that's going to. Some people are going to hear that and be like, okay, so there is time travel.
Which the Russos have flatly denied.
Yeah, they keep saying that something they use.
Barf.
That's what it's called?
Yes, the technology that Tony Stark uses to recreate his memories.
They keep saying they're going to play with that technology in the next part, and that's what we're seeing.
I mean, we've seen photos from the set of Black Widow with her red hair. We've seen shots of Cap with a more comics-accurate costume.
Which I love, by the way.
I mean, we've seen, Haley Atwell looking like Agent Carter again. So, I mean, there's been all these questions about, and they've been asked, and they said, well, you know, barf technology, there's reason we implanted that at the beginning of Civil War.
Yeah.
So, we'll see. But, I mean, I think this is a gut punch, because everything it's like Deadpool. Deadpool 2, great movie, fun time. You get to the post-credits stinger, and the entire reason for the movie existing is taken away.
Yeah.
I feel like, you work all that time to get to getting Janet Van Dyne home and having everybody have a nice, peaceable life, and then it's gone.
I didn't feel that way for this one, just because she wasn't the only one to go. I was upset that she left, but I don't feel like the rest of the movie is invalidated. Like, Deadpool, that was, and that's kind of like the joke of Deadpool. Everything is validated. This one, I mean, everything you work for, this is what it is. And it's like, this is life's cruel hand coming out. And like,
is it life's cruel hand? Because these odds are very random. Like, it does not, the balancing of like half of the universe is very random. It doesn't involve animals, obviously. But, I mean, like the way that it's divided up in Infinity War, the way it's been divided up by the Russos when they've been asked about other characters, the way that it's depicted here, I mean, 3-for-1?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this now based question is like, does Scott escape because he was in the Quantum Zone, or does it affect the Quantum Zone? You can ask that question now. I don't have an answer. But you know, it could have been 4-for-4 if Scott would have came back when he was supposed to. But yeah, that's just kind of where we left it. I know the second stinger is like really like nothing much to it, but I actually felt that disturbed me more than anything else with the snap, because it's just like, this is just what it looks like, and then we just get this shot of the ant just going, and it just like it. There's nothing creepy about the ant, but the ant just going about his business playing these drums while there's nothing else there, and we go through the house and all that. It kind of just, it weirded me out. And
it's the end of the world as we know it.
Yeah, and
the rapture's happened.
And that's
Snapture.
And that's the first time, even losing the 3 that we did, that in conjunction with the ant part, it made me like, okay, this is really where we're at again.
Even more so than Marina Hill and Nick Fury watching a jet run into the side of a building because the pilot got raptured. That was more acute to what it would be in a major city if the rapture actually happened and a good number were left behind.
If it would have ended with Sam Jackson saying mother and it just faded off, I probably would have felt probably stronger about that one. But that one, they had to give the audience hope. It's like, we cannot leave them on this complete downer. So when the Captain Marvel thing is coming, it gives you the hope, so it makes you feel a little better. This is just like despair. It's like, there's nothing but this ant that's just doing this because he's been programmed to do it to take Scott's place. And he is like completely oblivious that everything else is gone. So it was impactful to me.
Yes. So where do we sit now, Chad? We sit six, 8 months away from Captain Marvel. Mm-hmm. We sit with a marketing campaign that has to start eventually for Avengers 4. We have no title for Avengers 4 yet. We have no presence at Comic-Con in 3 weeks for Marvel Studios. We have no D23 this year. And we have a Spider-Man Homecoming movie that's coming in July, almost exactly 1 year from right now.
Yep.
Which also will eventually have to be marketed. And Spider-Man, as of right now, is still clinging on to Tony Stark and fading away.
Yep, even though he's currently shooting his movie right now.
Right. So, where do we stand? I mean, where do we go from here? Because Captain Marvel's a prequel set in the 90s, well before the events of Iron Man 1. We know Avengers 4 takes place, after Avengers Infinity War. We just don't know by how much. And we know that, of course, Homecoming Far From Home, or Spider-Man Far From Home, picks up minutes after the end of Avengers 4.
Yeah.
As Tom Holland is holding Tony Stark's babies.
So, from here, I don't think we're going to get any, indication of where Marvel's moving forward in, Avengers timeline until the very end of Captain Marvel. So, all of that said, I'm more interested.
They would have to put trailers out by that time.
Yeah, that's
they would have to put trailers out. You can't wait till March 3rd, 2019 to promote your movie that comes out May 3rd, 2019. Like, you can't wait till 2 months out.
No, just in my head, I would imagine that we're gonna get a trailer. And it's probably going to focus just on the guys that we know is back around. And we won't get anything further than that until after Captain Marvel. Because I doubt we get more than one trailer before Captain Marvel. And then once Captain Marvel hits, then they can ratchet it up. The tricky part is, how do you do Spider-Man in between all that? Especially since that is Sony's thing. And Sony's going to be like, look, I know what y'all doing over there. But, this is the one that counts for our money, so we need to start dishing these commercials out. So I'm interested how that little circus is going to go.
Do you think it's possible they could test the theory that we've always had about Star Wars? Where, you could literally just tell people there's a new Star Wars movie coming out December 2019, and people would just show it up?
When you originally said it just a minute ago, that was my first thought. And before Infinity War, I would say no. After Infinity War, they might be able to do it.
They might be able to just say, show up and see what happens on May 3rd, 2019.
I mean, there was no bigger reason to say show up on whatever date it is in 2019 than watching Infinity War and be like, yeah, see, Thanos is coming back. So that means you are too.
Yeah, I mean, I think they could actually pull it off.
Now, will they?
Disney has some guidelines to play with, but I mean, they play with house money over there at Marvel.
Yeah,
I mean, they're not in the dumpster fire Lucasfilm is right now.
No. This Infinity War just made over $2 billion.
It will not be the highest grossing domestic Marvel movie of the year.
Nope.
Black Panther is gonna almost cross $700 million domestically.
Yeah.
What kind of odds could you have gotten on that back in January? Man, Black Panther would outgross Infinity War at the domestic box office.
With that knowledge, we could have went to Vegas and cleaned up. There was nobody putting that money on it. Nobody. I wish the home release was a month later than what it was, because it probably could have crossed 700.
It would have. And that's all of that is rarefied air.
Yes. And well deserved at that.
So, our expectations for Captain Marvel?
No, right now, I'm not.
Kree Skull War, 90s set, Two-Eyed Nick Fury. Jude Law.
We're so far, we're not that far, but we're far enough out that I'm I don't really have a feeling about this movie so far. I guess I'm going to say I'm indifferent. Now, my indifferent is, I'm still going to be there on opening night. I expect it to be good. It's just right now I have no feelings about this movie. I think it'll change as soon as I see something. But as of right now, I don't really have any expectations for it.
I don't have any concept visualization of how you depict the Kree Skull War. And, like, what that looks like. And I don't have an idea of character designs. There hasn't been enough leakage out there for me to get a good idea of what they're going to do with those guys. So, you know, it's South Louisiana. It's going to, you know,
just randomly rain.
Randomly rain. So, I mean, I just... That's my thought, anyway, about it. I think that until I can see a set photo or an EW spread, and I can get an idea of what Jude Law looks like as Mar-Vell, if I can get an idea of what she looks like outside of just that green and black costume, if I can get an idea of what some of the other pieces around that are going to look like, you know, I'll have a better idea of what I can expect.
I think that's pretty much where I'm at.
So, box office predictions?
I'm going to go 80. I would like to see it more than that, but I think 80 is good for where this is.
I'll go 78.5. 78.5 million. That almost doubles. It was 55 million, 55 or 52 million for the first one, which represents our first podcast together was the Ant-Man.
That was
the original Ant-Man review episode, which, you know, was July of 2015, so that means the podcast has been going for 3 years.
3 years.
Yeah, 3 years. So, you know, it's just, I think they're in an interesting place, and I think that this movie will make enough money to greenlight a third one, and I just don't think we're ever going to get another slate announcement. I think we're just going to be, at some point, we'll get the news on 2020, because you got to start shooting stuff in 2019, but...
You know, I'm not upset with that. That's fine. If that's how they want to do it, we don't need to know everything all the way out in advance.
Yeah, I think that I remember the stories of Whedon being ticked off that, like, I've got to promote, you know, Age of Ultron next May, and you just told everybody that people are living all the way to 2018.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what good is it for me, you know? So, all right, so that'll about do it for this week's podcast. If you want to keep up with us on Twitter, I am at BCW Tiger Fan.
At the Mets Theory.
Now, I have officially challenged on Independence Day T-Bob Hebert to an eating contest. He has laughed in my face. I maintain that I have this challenge, and that if he can beat me, I will renounce my Pepper Potts fandom. However, T-Bob has refused to take up said challenge. So, until T-Bob takes up my challenge, we will continue to get Pepper Potts updates and regular reminders that Mark Sanchez is the greatest living American and a wonderful quarterback.
Help me, T-Bob, Juan Kenobi. You're my only hope. I need to end this.
Yes. So that'll about do it. We will talk to you again next week.